Good morning, everyone, and thanks for joining our Q1 call. With me in the room today are Mark Zinkler, CEO of LGIM, Duncan Finch, MD of Insurance, Jackie Noakes, MD of Mature Savings, and Mike Berry, MD of Digital Savings. On the line, we have Kerrigan Procter, MD of L&G Retirement, and Paul Stanworth, MD of L&G Capital. The top-line numbers are that operational cash is up 11% year-on-year at 330 million pounds. Net cash is up 8% at 226 million. LGIM's total assets are up 17% compared to Q1 2014 at 737 billion pounds. Annuity assets are up 19% at 45.6 billion pounds. Savings AUA up 11% at 113 billion, and U.K. protection premiums are up 5% at 372 million pounds. Our strategy remains to drive growth in our business based on five global macro long-term trends, namely aging populations, welfare reform, globalization of asset markets, digital lifestyles, and retrenching banks. All of these trends have played a part in today's numbers. Turning to our businesses and starting with L&G Retirement. Our stock of annuity assets has increased to 45.6 billion pounds, with sales in the first quarter of over three-quarters of a billion pounds, including 655 million of bulk annuity transactions. Individual remain a key part of our at-retirement proposition, and sales totaled 99 million pounds in quarter one. Pensions Freedom started on 6th of April 2015, and we're offering our customers various propositions in response to these new freedoms. This includes lifetime mortgages, where we've completed the acquisition of Newlife Home Finance and are now active in the market. Moving to LGIM, which now has total assets of 737 billion pounds. External AUM net flows in the first quarter were a healthy 4.3 billion pounds, driven by continued demand for LGIM's pension de-risking capabilities and further expansion of its international operations in the U.S. and Asia. Total international pounds. Workplace Pensions, which is now a part of LGIM, grew assets under administration to 13 billion pounds, up 43% year-on-year. Our insurance business had a solid first quarter, with U.K. retail protection gross written premiums up 6% and U.K. group protection up 3%. Legal & General Savings, which now comprises digital and mature savings, increased its assets under administration by 11% to 113 billion pounds. Digital savings had net inflows of just under 1 billion pounds in the first quarter, and our Cofunds platform now has 76 billion pounds of assets. L&G Capital remains focused on increasing the risk-adjusted returns on shareholder funds. A further 400 million pounds of new direct investments were completed in the quarter. The group's total direct investments are now 6.3 billion pounds, up 62% year-on-year. The price changes introduced last year by Legal & General America resulted in sales of $31 million compared to $38 million in Q1 2014. Gross premiums, however, increased 5% to $283 million. Turning to outlook, we positioned our businesses to grow as the long-term macro trends play out over time. We made a good start to 2015, and the business has momentum, both in the U.K. and increasingly so internationally. In terms of regulatory capital, we've updated you on where we are with the Solvency II process. Discussions with the PRA are ongoing. This is an iterative process, and we will provide updates as clarity emerges. Final clarity is not expected until late in Q4 this year. In summary, our stock of business is up, cash generation is up, our businesses have momentum and growth opportunities. Finally, we remain confident in delivering the 2015 operational cash guidance we gave at the time of the 2014 prelims. I now open the call to questions.
Our first question on the line comes from Andy Sinclair of Bank of America Merrill Lynch. Andy, please go ahead.
Thanks, and good morning, everyone. Three questions, if that's okay. Firstly, can you tell us the level of regular premiums flow that you're now seeing coming into workplace pensions on a quarterly basis, if you excluded any transfers in of existing assets, just to get an idea of the underlying flow per quarter? Second, you've mentioned that large workplace schemes are being rebroked. Just wondered if you could give us an idea of what the reasons are for these schemes leaving their existing providers and what L&G is doing that others didn't. And thirdly, just on Solvency II, just wondered if you could confirm for us that the application for transitionals doesn't affect your dividend policy and moving to 1.5 times cover by net cash generation by the end of the year. Thanks.
Okay, Andy, thanks for those. I'll pick those up quickly, unless Mark comes up with a bit of colour if he wants to add on the workplace. In terms of the flows, year on year, we had 0.5 billion of inflows in the first quarter of this year, so similar to where we were last year. A slight difference in terms of the makeup, Andy. So I think last year we had more pension transfers come with the scheme wins, whereas this year I think we're seeing more of the regular premiums coming through quarter in, quarter out. So in some ways the kind of compounding effect of the flywheel of regular contributions beginning to have an impact in workplace. So in absolute terms, the cash flow looks similar, but actually the makeup slightly changing. We're now seeing, you know, the benefit of having more members on our auto-enrollment platform. You know, obviously with pay rises, etc. You know, that impact coming through. So similar, I say, slightly different colour than what we had this time last year. In terms of the kind of general rebroke in the workplace market, I don't think at this stage many schemes have actually been formally rebroked. We are seeing some interest, potentially from broker firms themselves, in terms of whether to revisit some of their earlier decisions. I mean, certainly some of the companies have perhaps used perhaps a final salary type solution to actually comply with the auto-enrollment rules when it first came in. I think some of those companies employers are now looking at whether that was the right answer and therefore whether a more DC-focused solution might be right. So certainly we are seeing quite a lot of activity in that space. But certainly the general interest in workplace remains very, very high. In terms of the impact of transitionals and there's any impact on the dividend policy, and we said today that we will be applying for a transitional provision as part of our Solvency II application. Now, we won't know whether that's needed or the size of that until the end of this year, because it's based on the end of 2015 balance sheet. To be absolutely clear, the transitional rules are very clear cut, so any transitional relief will come straight off the technical provisions. Now, that boosts own funds. Now, that's a key component of the Solvency II balance sheet, so it will have no impact on the on dividend policy. And clearly, you know, our dividend policy remains as we stated at year end 2 months ago.
Very good. Thank you.
Next question comes from Andrew Crean of Autonomous. Andrew, please go ahead.
Good morning. Actually, can I follow up on that question on transitionals? If you apply transitionals for one subsidiary, would you then be blocked from getting dividends up from that subsidiary to group in the case where, you know, presumably you're trying to build capital in a subsidiary rather than reduce it through dividends?
So just one question, Andrew. Sorry, I might be asking more than one question, Andrew. Just to be absolutely clear on that point, I mean, I'll probably reiterate the answer I just gave to Andy on the previous question. Now, transitionals are clear-cut in the way they work. They're absolutely clear. They come off technical provisions, i.e. they reduce your technical provisions, therefore they increase own funds, and the Solvency II balance sheet surplus will be cut on the overall state of the overall balance sheet. So it's not about component parts, it's the total balance sheet. So we're not foreseeing any issues with any blockage of dividend flows up the group.
So no fungibility issues from your annuity company in terms
Correct.
Of getting dividends up. Okay, thank you.
Our next question comes from Greg Patterson of KBW. Greg, please go ahead.
Morning, gentlemen. Just three quick questions. One is, in terms of new business release bulks, what's the sort of outlook? Stable, up, down for the rest of the year? I just want to understand the trend there in that sort of margin. I noticed on the individual annuities, you had a jump in the first quarter versus the fourth quarter last year, which is unusual in the run-up to the A-Day. I was wondering why that was. Did you launch a new product or was there some kind of phenomena going on there? And then the third question, in terms of cost-cutting the 18 million, I wonder if you could sort of, you know, now that you're further into the program, give us an idea of how much of that 18 million will fall through to the bottom line, and of that, how much is actually coming through within the target to achieve break-even on the workplace savings business.
Okay, thanks, Greg. Kerry, Greg, you're on the line. Hopefully you still are. Can you answer the question on bulk trend and individual annuities, what happened in first quarter, and I'll come back and say a few words on the cost-cutting program.
Absolutely. Thanks for the questions, Greg. In terms of new business release and the trend in margin, really not seeing any change in that trend. We continue to find what we think are attractive assets, attractively priced assets, to allow us to support that. We didn't disclose separately the new business margin, but the ongoing trend in.
So it's roughly unchanged.
New business. Yeah, roughly unchanged at the moment. Of course, you know, we always come back to our point that we have an internal return on capital hurdle metric, and we've applied that consistently throughout. So you probably expect something similar in terms of trend.
And then the individual annuities, why it jumped quarter on quarter?
I think probably Q1. No new products in Q1. They came in Q2 with Freedom and Choice on April the 6th. So no new products in Q1. We just found ourselves a little bit more competitive while retaining our price discipline. So slightly up from where we were in Q4. But I think the Q4 Q1 run rate is broadly what we're expecting.
You don't have cap drawdown in there, do you?
No, we don't. No, no, no. That's just individual annuities.
Okay, and on the cost cutting point, Greg, as you say, we did highlight we were targeting £80 million of absolute cost saves this year. Obviously, did also at the same time, Greg, we expected to spend roughly £40 million of restructuring costs to achieve it. So before we get too excited about any bottom line impact, we will have to expense the restructuring costs at the same time. Broadly, again, we haven't given too much to it. As I said, when we announced it at year end, some of this is just to reflect the fact some of our books are more mature in nature and therefore will have a decline in revenue profile. Therefore, some of this is just good housekeeping to make sure that our cost profile reflects some of our revenue profile to some of those more mature books. As a kind of rough rule of thumb, Greg, I'd expect probably about half or just over half of that net benefit to drop through to the bottom line. Again, that's not a precise number at this stage, but just give you some steer about what impact you might see from that. And in terms of the impact you asked specifically about workplace savings, I mean, every part of the organisation is playing its part. You know, I would say we've designed workplace, you know, to be a highly automated process in the first place, and then we have a highly automated onboarding process there. So I think in terms of the net, probably workplace won't be one of the major beneficiaries from the explicit cost save program.
All right. Thank you.
Our next question comes from Fahid Chaganza from Nomura. Fahid, please go ahead.
Thank you. Good morning. I'm sorry, I might have missed the answer to Craig's question on bulk annuities. Are we expecting bulk annuity premiums in full year 2015 to be up on full year 2014? Just two other questions. One on LGIM. It looks like the index funds are doing better in Q1. I know we had a big one last year with Tesco, but could you give some guidance on outlook, how we should be thinking about outflows from the index funds this time around? Should we take Tesco out from last year and then model up increasing outflows from 2014? And the final question is on LGC. Could you just remind us again of your ambition for total assets in LGC and any color on how much of that will be direct investments? Thanks.
Great, thanks for that. Kerry, can you just pick up the clarification point on the bulk's outlook? Sink, if you pick up the comment on index, and Paul at the end pick up the comment on our ambitions for our asset profile within LGC.
Yep.
Great. Yeah, Fahid, thanks for that. Really, my answer to Greg was more around the new business release and margin. In terms of premiums, well, I'd say 2014, $5.9 billion of bulk premiums was really an outstanding record year. I'd view that as a tough hurdle to beat, shall we say? I think $650 million Q1 was a good result in bulks in Q1. plenty of pipeline out there. We talked about 10 billion pipeline in the markets, and I think that pretty much remains out there. So there's plenty of demand from the clients, and we'll just be selective about which deals make sense for us in terms of our internal hurdle metrics. So positive, but it's a lumpy business, and we'll be selective.
Okay, Mark.
In regards to our index business, we are seeing more inflows through the first part of the year outside of UK DB channels. So consistent growth in other channels locally. I've won our first couple of mandates in the US. We'll talk more about this at half year. There'll be more activity over the first half of the year. And then I've won a couple of mandates recently in Asia, which I've not funded yet. So we're having good progress and much better progress in growing our index assets in other channels. In regards to the outflows, last year we did have an unusual number of kind of one large one-off event. So in terms of what to model, I think you have to look at this. We looked at outflows of passive equities from UK DB plans as AD risk. And fortunately, we've seen that more than offset by growth in our solutions business. That trend will continue. But again, it will be somewhat uneven year to year and certainly quarter to quarter. We are doing a much better job, though, in retaining assets that are switching out of passive equities into other products, de-risking products, which shows up in our market and other item, line item, movement line item. So we are doing a better job. We've expanded our range of LDI solutions and our fixed income offerings, as well as into property as well. We're seeing a lot of switches, a higher level of switches into those other products, which not just retains assets, but in most cases also enhances our revenues.
That's Mark. Paul?
Yeah, thanks, Fahid. So LGC is looking after a portfolio of around $5 billion. The returns on the overall portfolio were around 4.5%. And out of the portfolio, around $1.5 billion of that was equities, and we've been acquiring direct investments effectively over time to replace equity at around £500 million a year. What it allows us to do is contribute to operating businesses and projects which can help the access to assets for the annuity funds and also provide co-investment opportunities for LGIM's funds as well. So the ambition, which was your question, is to replace effectively the traded assets we have in equities with real assets for superior returns that give us better access to assets for the annuity fund and bring in more clients for LGIM. And overall, there'll be a sort of enhanced return from those other business units as a consequence of the assets that we purchase. Our focus is on, which Nigel reiterated, I think, in the last results, our main focus is housing and urban regeneration, and also we are looking at where there are opportunities in the energy space and alternative finance.
Okay, that's great. Thank you.
Our next question comes from Ravi Tanan from Goldman Sachs. Ravi, please go ahead.
Hi, good morning. Thank you. Just one question, please, on the impact of the pension freedoms on defined benefit pension schemes. A number of your peers and also some of the actuarial consulting firms were referring to an uptick in the number of inquiries from customers in DB schemes who are looking to transfer into DC schemes so that they can ultimately cash in their pension pots. So just wondering what your experience has been of this. Have you also seen an uptick, and do you expect it to be a material impact at all on your business? Thank you.
Thanks, Ravi. Kerrigan, do you want to comment on that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, it's certainly been a well-discussed topic that deferred pensions could be approached to switch their pensions to DC and then cash them in when they get to 55. I think it's been more discussion rather than action, and even though inquiries have gone in probably for people checking their pension amounts, I haven't seen a lot of actual action in terms of transfers. I think it's more challenging to actually go ahead and do it because you need to get an IFA's advice, show the trustees you've got an IFA advice, and then find a DC provider who will accept the cash. So it's a fairly involved process. So no impact on our business as yet can't really see that being a substantial impact on our business going forward. And in fact, I think if DB schemes tackle that by reducing their deficit by transferring cash for deferreds, it would actually free up the market to do even more bulk transfers for pensioners. So probably overall it might be a positive if it does pick up, but no pickup I've seen yet.
Brilliant. That's very clear. Thank you.
Our next question comes from Anasuya Iyer from Jefferies. Anasuya, please go ahead.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my question. I just want to ask about, come back to the U.S. Outlook question. When I think about your business in the U.K., I think of it across the pensions de-risking spectrum. So I think about index, LDI, plus bulk together. Should I think the same way in the U.S., or should I think of it separately there with you focusing on the index mandates instead of the entire spectrum? And my other question was, with U.S. expansion, is there any Solvency II issue there? I know a lot of European players talk a lot about Solvency II equivalence for the U.S. businesses. Is there something there that I should think about for you as well? Thanks.
Okay. I think perhaps you comment on the more general LDI index stuff in U.S.
From a market perspective, you should certainly think about thematically, the U.S. is going through the same transition in its pension, its pension landscape as the U.K. Their DB plans are de-risking, and there's a shift from DB to DC. This is playing out in the details. It's playing out a bit differently in each country. And ironically, the DB market is ahead of the U.K. In the U.K. is ahead of the U.S. in de-risking, but the U.S. is way ahead of the U.K. in the growth of the D.C. market. But it's the same general trends that are happening. From an LGIM perspective or an LNG perspective, since we our history is in the U.K. market, we established a sizable and market-leading position in the U.K. DB market, which we were then protecting and have been growing, actually, as that market's gone from the growth phase to the maturity phase and ultimately into annuitization or some kind of buyout, buy-in, longevity, risk offloading phase, which then obviously flows into Kerrigan's business. In the U.S., since we entered the market kind of already in this maturity phase, we're establishing our business as a market-leading LDI business. So that's, we built our business starting with our LDI business rather than index business for those reasons. But we're now adding the index business to it. And then, obviously, Kerrigan can talk about, his plans for expanding into annuity space, but clearly we see that as a growth market in the U.S. as pension plans continue to mature and those that can afford it and desire to do so will ultimately pursue some kind of longevity risk offloading strategy.
Okay, and on your second question about any impact of Solvency II on our U.S. expansion, I think it's fair to say that a lot of our expansion currently is coming through LGIM, and actually as a non-insurance business, that is not impacted by Solvency II in any way. Just more general Solvency, I'd say almost certainly most of our risk capital and Solvency will be deployed in the U.K., and therefore it would need quite a material change to our model for actually anything we're doing in the U.S. to make much of a difference to our Solvency II balance sheet. So I'm not saying it's completely immaterial, but I'm simply saying it's unlikely to be a big driver of our ambitions in the U.S.
Okay, thank you.
Our next question comes from Abid Hussain from Societe Generale. Abid, please go ahead.
Hi, morning all. Three questions from me, if I may. The first one on bulk annuities. On the surface of it, it appears you're focusing on smaller cases in certainly in Q1. Can you just talk about the competitive landscape at the small end, the mid end, and the large end in terms of bulk annuity transactions? The second question is on co-funds. Co-fund net flows were about half of what they were this time last year. Can you just talk about what's driving that slowdown, as we had expected a ramp up in flows by now? And then finally, my last question is on Solvency II. You mentioned in the press release this morning the use of transitional arrangements. Can you just talk about what product that might relate to? I'm assuming it's probably annuities. And can you also just talk about what restrictions, if any, the regulator might apply should you go down the transitional route? Thanks.
OK,
Okay, thanks, Amit. So, Kerry, if you pick up the bolts question, Mike, if you pick up the co-funds flows point, and I'll come back on the Solvency II impact.
Great, thanks a bit. On bolts, I think what you can say about the bolt market, it's anything but it's not homogenous. So even if you look at the 650 million, that's 15 contracts, but they weren't all equal size. There's two larger ones in that, let's say probably in the medium size in terms of your description of the market, and then a few smaller deals. I guess just in terms of competitive nature, the large deals are just very lumpy. We think we have a USP in that space. It's probably only ourselves who do the larger ones, or maybe there's a couple of other firms who get involved. Medium and small certainly felt the impact of the change of freedom and choice in pensions and increased competition there. So we did less in that market in the last year. Probably less overall in Q1, but that's starting to come back. That's starting to become slightly more attractive now. So I think the kind of initial reactions have worn through, and pricing is starting to look a bit more even across the competition there. And mediums probably somewhere between the small and large, slightly fewer competitors in the medium space. So again, the medium space is probably where the majority of the 650 million came from in Q1. So definitely some attractive deals for us.
Perhaps now if I turn to co-funds, you're quite correct. The inflows into co-funds were a little lower in the first quarter of 2015 than the first quarter of 2014. You need to see the co-funds business as being two things. There's institutional flows and there are retail flows. The institutional flows tend to be a little bit more erratic depending upon the deals with particular customers. The first quarter of last year, we had particularly strong flows into our institutional business. So the reduction in net flows over the year represents a reduction in institutional inflow.
Okay. Your question on kind of transitional, what impact it might have on particular products. Just taking a step back, the transitionals work on a total balance sheet basis, so you simply compare your total technical provisions under Solvency II compared to where you were for the same thing under Solvency I. They're calculated on a different basis, and if your Solvency II technical provisions are higher than Solvency I, then you get transitional relief for the difference. So in reality, it's a total balance sheet impact rather than any particular products themselves being affected by it, and therefore, as I said earlier to the previous question from Andy and Andrew, we're not foreseeing any restrictions being inappropriate on the back of that the way the balance sheet will work in a Solvency II regime.
Okay, thanks. That's very helpful.
Our next question comes from Gordon Aitken from RBC. Gordon, please go ahead.
Hey, morning. Thanks. I've got three questions on bulk annuities, please. First, in the UK, several schemes have bought buy-ins from you on a slice of their liabilities. That's been an increasing trend. I just wonder what proportion of these do you expect to be pretty much repeat buyers? And just give a sense of the size of this repeat business and also the probability. That's the first question. The second one is on the US, following up from a previous question. Someone asked about, you know, how you're pushing on here. And I understand you were... your way in was to sell LDI mandates to big pension funds there. So I just wonder how many of, say, the top, let's just say, top 100 pension funds in the US or whatever number you want to give me, are you managing LDI mandates for currently? And the third question on the Dutch market, you talked about some intent here, and I'm assuming that you'd only look at post-retirement liabilities. And I just wonder, is this quite a small opportunity or small potential market at the moment, given that lots of the schemes in Holland are still open? Thanks.
Okay, thanks, Gordon. I think, Kerry, then most of those, if you, Mark, you want to just chip in on the LDI point in the US, but Kerry, if you just perhaps answer those three.
Yeah, fantastic. Mark, I will hand over to you for the comments on number of LDI mandates in the US for the top 100. But just in terms of UK buy-ins, I think it's a very, very good point. It's definitely part of our business model. Our bulk annuities new business team is split into two parts, strategic and core. And strategic is really about setting up relationships with the top 200 pension schemes, very much with the idea that in an ideal situation, there'd be a large initial transaction and then further slices of new business. And so it's developed into far more of a relationship management business. So I would put it as quite high probability that we'll get repeat business from that kind of strategic relationship with the largest clients. In terms of the U.S., clearly an interesting market for a first, Mark, did you want to talk, say something about the...
I'll be really brief because my answer is I don't know off the top of my head. We have, at the top, in terms of your question, the number of top 100 pension funds that are clients, I don't know that exact number. It would be a substantial number, though, for the top, whatever, top 5 or top 10 pension funds are clients. And just given the inherent nature of our business model, as you can imagine, a significant percentage of our assets would be with the largest plans in the country because they are going to be the first to implement these kinds of strategies and obviously do them in size. So for both of those reasons, a substantial percentage of our assets are with the 100 largest plans in the country, and that portion will continue to grow over time as they continue to implement, you know, their de-risking strategies as they hit their various targets. I just don't know the exact number off the top of my head, but we can get back to you with that.
Yeah, just finally on the Dutch market. Sorry, go on.
No, go on, sorry. Back to you.
Just finally on the Dutch market. I mean, we are interested in entering as a reinsurer, probably as much as a direct writer there. Definitely some opportunities for us that we're following up. We have our longevity pricing basis and investment strategy all set so that we're comfortable with that. And there are deals to be done, but you're right to say that it feels like a smaller market than the UK and the US, certainly. But we'd expect to see some action there. There's certainly some deals in the markets pipeline and things that we're interested in.
So just on that last point, you would reinsure, you'd be reinsuring the major Dutch insurance companies who are writing this business?
Well, probably that's the first option to provide capacity to the market in that way. Although there are some ways in which you could enter as a reinsurer directly with pension schemes, but that's probably a bit further down the line.
Okay, thanks very much.
Our next question is from John Hocking from Morgan Stanley. John, please go ahead.
Morning, everybody. I've got three questions, please. Two on Solvency II and one on bulks. on the Solvency II point around the transitionals, I think what you're saying seems to be different than the message we had from the PRU at Folio. It may be sort of a nuance, but they seem to be talking about taking the transitionals on a discrete basis for the annuity fund rather than applying it across their entire UK business. So I wonder if you could comment on that. Secondly, I just wonder whether you or the industry had any idea yet about how you're going to communicate when you had some final idea about where the Solvency II numbers sat, whether you were going to talk about when you had model approval, is this going to be a 15 event or a 16 event? And then just finally on bulks, just on the pipeline, just wonder whether you're seeing any impact on the pipeline from the sort of funding pressure we've seen on DB schemes in the course of the sort of recent reporting season from the corporates in the UK. Thank you.
Okay, I'll pick up the first two then, John. Just on the transitionals point, I'm not entirely sure what Nick said at the PRU prelims. I'm sure he was technically right what he said, but the way that it works, it is done on a regulated entity balance sheet basis, so it will be done for each entity and at group level based on the actual, as I said earlier, the difference between the technical provisions under Solvency I and Solvency II. So that is the way the directive is set out. It's very clear-cut, and that's the way it's going to operate in practice.
Just to follow up on that, some of your competitors have talked about a sort of partial internal model basis and effectively choosing entity by entity whether they use an internal model or a standard formula. So I'm just surprised you'll say you're going to apply it to the entire business.
I'm saying do it on a regulated entity basis. So we have various regulated entities within L&G Group, and then it will also apply at group level. But within that, we will have certain entities which will be done on a standard formula, which are less important from our perspective. Yeah. And some on an internal model basis. So I think we're saying the same thing.
Okay, so you're not saying you're going to use the transitionals for the entire group balance sheet. It's going to be the transitionals for discrete entities where it makes sense.
Correct. But then
so you're saying exactly the same as the PRU?
It then aggregates up to group level. Yes, okay. We're saying the same thing.
Okay, fine. Okay, thank you.
In terms of communication, I guess we're all in the same camp here. We're all obviously fairly fluid, ongoing negotiations and discussions with the regulator. I would envisage John will only get clarity very late in this year, and I wouldn't be surprised if the PRA don't try and coordinate it to make sure we all get the feedback pretty much the same time. I think it would make sense to do that to an extent. But I think in terms of your expectations, I think it could well be very, very late 2015. Indeed, you could easily be slipping into 2016 before we have the absolute clarity the market would like to have at this point.
Okay.
And Kerrigan on bulks?
Yeah, just the impact on funding pressures. I mean, in terms of the, you know, what I talk about, the market pipeline out there, I mentioned the 10 billion figure of the kind of people who are looking for quotes to transact. Just to be clear, they might not all transact this year, but I think most of those have probably gone down the de-risking route or LDI route in some ways. So actually the continuing fall or lower for longer interest rates hasn't had so much of an impact on them. So no impact that size. Clearly, those further away from de-risking or just embarking on the de-risking route, they'll be the ones probably most impacted by what you've seen in reports and accounts on the size of pension deficits, and so therefore may have a longer journey to go before they're ready to proceed to actual pension risk transfer. They'll be looking actively at pension risk management, so they'll be definitely courted by our LGM business.
Okay, very clear. Thank you very much.
Our next question comes from Alan Devlin from Barclays. Alan, please go ahead.
Hi, guys. Thanks. Just a couple of questions for me. First of all, your new business strain was quite low in the quarter, even without the benefit of any large bugs. I wonder if you could tell us what's driving that, and is that sustainable if you don't have any major bugs throughout the year? And then just secondly, on your retail protection business, I know you've got a large share of the market there, but the premiums were up and sales were down. I wonder if you could give us some color about what's going on in that market and what the outlook is. Thanks.
Okay, thanks, Alan. I'll pick up the first one on new business strain, and Duncan, you can comment on the dynamics in the retail protection market right now. I mean, clearly, at Q1 and Q3, Alan, we don't give the exact breakdown of by component part of op cash strain and net cash. To give a little bit of color, though, I mean, some of the benefits we get are simply come from greater scale, full stop. So, you know, some of the unit costs, etc., some of our overheads, etc., you know, the bigger the books are in total, so some of those unit cost benefits come through to new business strain or surplus as well. So some of this is just the fact that the organisation gets bigger, you know, so we spread our fixed costs more generally, and therefore the impact on each component, such as new business strain, does reduce. So a bit of that is going on in the dynamic as well. We'll show a bit more colour at the half year when we actually give the detailed breakdown. But now clearly we are very active in managing the amount of capital and strain we incur in writing new business. And that's been true for quite a while now at L&G. Duncan, just to pick up retail protection.
Yeah, just on retail protection. So first quarter, yeah, we're satisfied with the performance that we had in first quarter in retail protection. Quarter 1/15 did reflect slightly lower volumes of retail protection business compared to the same quarter in 2014. That was a very strong quarter. But underneath that, the underlying business that we have in retail protection continues to perform very strongly. New business obviously is only part of the story, and as Mark said earlier on, overall GWP for retail protection is up 6% year on year. In terms of full-year outlook, I'd just direct you to the outlook statement that we've got that talks about where we will be on the full year in terms of new business volumes and margin.
Cool, thanks.
Our next question comes from Ashik Musaddi from JP Morgan. Ashik, please go ahead.
Yeah, hi, good morning, everyone. So a couple of questions. First of all, sorry if you've already answered this, but can you tell us, like, what sort of transition arrangements are you using? Is it mainly on the discount rate? Is it mainly on the asset risk charges? So some sort of color on that. Secondly, I guess you have a big deferred annuity book as well in your annuities. I think it's around 4 or 5 billion. So whereas I heard that there is no matching adjustment will be applicable on this particular book as of now. So any thoughts on that? What are you doing with that book? Is there any issues with respect to capital on that particular book? How you'll be using that under Solvency II? And thirdly, I mean, just to cross-check, the lower volumes in bulk annuities, has it to do anything with Solvency II, i.e., are you pulling back on bulk annuities at the moment because of uncertainty on Solvency II, or is it, no, it is just a timing thing rather than anything else? Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Ashik. I'll probably pick up all those myself. Again, I feel a bit like a crack record on the transitional point. I keep going back to it. Transitionals are calculated based on total technical provisions by regulated entity comparing Solvency II with Solvency I. That is the way the rules work. So I think people are looking for shadows which don't exist. It's very clear cut. It's defined in the directive. Now, we will make an application. We won't actually know whether we need them or to what size we're going to need them until it'll be based on the 31/12/15 balance sheet. So that's the way the rules are going to work in practice. In terms of your point around match adjustment applicability to deferred annuities, I'm afraid you're just wrong on that. The MA rules, and whether it's deferred or an annuity in payment, doesn't matter. It's still eligible for match adjustment treatment. And your final one about whether we're pulling back on volumes in respect of with one eye on Solvency II, I think Kerrigan's already picked that the point earlier on. In reality, the dynamics of the market are that the bulk market remains pretty lumpy. Now, with 655 was a good first quarter for bulks. Clearly, we recognise that Solvency II is coming down the track, and we're happily writing new business and recognising the likely landscape of the capital regime post this year. So certainly no impact on Solvency II in terms of the amount of business we're writing in the bulk space.
Yeah, thanks a lot for your clarity. But just coming back on your bulk deferred annuity point, now, I thought that matching adjustment is only applicable to businesses where you have fixed cash inflows and fixed cash outflows, i.e. there is no optionality. But if you think about deferred annuity book, my sense is that there is a huge amount of optionality because of the recent pension freedom. Okay, so would matching adjustment still apply on that? Sorry, I got a bit confused on that. So any color on that would be really great. Thank you.
I stick to my answer I gave earlier, Ashit. We still fully expect the match adjustment to apply to both deferred and the pensions in payment on our annuity book.
Okay, that's very clear. Thank you.
Okay, I think that's probably the last of the call, so... I thank you all for your interest this morning, and we'll see you again shortly.